Last time we studied, we covered practically all of the 14th chapter of Deuteronomy. And there are a couple of points I'd like to dwell on a little bit further in that 14th chapter. Then we'll move on to the 15th chapter. As you will recall, that chapter had to do primarily with two things. One, talking about the dietary restrictions that God placed upon his people. And this included the idea that they could not eat any animal that didn't chew the cud or part the hoof into two sides. Of the birds, they could eat any bird that wasn't a scavenger, and he names a whole list of birds that were forbidden to be eaten. And of the fish, they had to have fins and scales to be able to eat, to be eaten as fish. Then the second part of that chapter, he talked about the tithing. So I'd like to say one thing about the first part, comment on one scripture in 1 Timothy 4, verses 4 through 5, to show that apparently the New Testament does not make these dietary restrictions that were made upon the Hebrew people. 1 Timothy 4, beginning with the first verse. Now the Spirit speaketh expressly that in the latter times some should depart from the faith, giving heed to seducing spirits and doctrines of devils, speaking lies and hypocrisy, having their conscience seared with a hot iron, forbidding to marry, and commanding to abstain from meats, which God hath created to be received with thanksgiving of them which believe and know the truth. For every creature of God is good, and nothing to be refused if it be received with thanksgiving, for it is sanctified by the word of God and prayer. Now to me that's a very significant scripture teaching that we do not have those same restrictions concerning meats that they had in the Old Testament. Also, you know, last time we cited the example in Acts, the 8th chapter, where all manner of animals were being let down from heaven in this sheet, in the vision that Peter had. And the Lord said, "Rise, Peter, kill and eat." And then he says, "What the Lord has cleansed, that call not thou common." Indicating that, of course, that the Gentiles were now cleansed to him, but he showed it by the fact that these meats also were cleansed. Then, in the second part of that 14th chapter, we talked about the tithing. We were dwelling on God's law of prosperity to us in the New Testament when the time ran out. And I would like to briefly look at those scriptures again concerning God's law of prosperity to us. We are not told in the New Testament directly to tithe. Actually, if we were commanded to tithe, then that would limit us. We couldn't give more than 10% if we had a command to tithe and no other further commands about giving. But as you know, all of our examples show that no less than a tithe has ever been given to God in the Bible that we have any record of. So certainly a 10% would be a good starting point, and it's the only thing that we can refer to for any kind of a Bible example. But there's more to prosperity than just following a certain law about how much to give. In 1 Timothy 6, verses 6 through 10, he gives one of the great laws there of prosperity. He says, "But godliness with contentment is great gain, for we brought nothing into this world, and it's certain we can carry nothing out, and having food and raiment, let us be therewith content." We need to learn how to be content. To be content with food and raiment and godliness. And to always realize that godliness with contentment is great gain. Now, talking about great gain, that is great gain. And there are very few things that we can do in this life that we can truly say after we've done them that they have brought us great gain. But godliness with contentment is one of the attitudes that we must have. So let's learn to have godliness, which is going to cause us to have industry, and it's going to cause us to have a care and a consideration for our family and want to be providers and so on, but godliness, and then to be content with godliness. And he says, food and raiment, be content. The second point that I'd like to refer to again is in Ephesians 4, verse 28, where he says, "Let him that stole steal no more, but let him work with his hands, the thing which is good, that he may have to give to him that needeth. There again, we're to have a work that is a good work. We work with our hands so that we may have to give to him that needeth. This not only provides for our needs, but it also provides for the needs of him that needeth. Now, this rule applies to us today. It's given in the New Testament. It also is intertwined with what's said here in the Old Testament. And it also is going to be applicable to some of the things that we have in the next chapter, this 15th chapter of Deuteronomy. Then the third point that I wanted to make about God's law of prosperity to us today is found in 2 Corinthians, the 8th chapter, and also the 9th chapter, where he's talking about taking up the collection for the poor saints in Jerusalem. In the 8th chapter, he says, beginning with verse 13, "For I mean not that other men be eased and ye be burdened, but by an equality, that now at this time your abundance may be a supply for their want, that their abundance also may be a supply for your want, that there may be equality. As it is written, he that had gathered much had nothing over, and he that had gathered little had no lack." So God intends that we in the kingdom have more or less of an equality among ourselves. Now, he doesn't forbid somebody to have wealth and to have all of the things that go with riches and ease as far as the comforts of life. But what he doesn't want is for one person to be overly laden with riches and another person to be in poverty and to have a lack, to not be able to have the things that are necessary. And so when one has an abundance, he expects that one then to contribute to the other one who doesn't have an abundance so that there is more of an equality. This is further borne out in the 9th chapter of 2 Corinthians, beginning with the 6th verse. "But this I say," now remember, he's talking about taking up the collection for the saints here. This is the collection taken on the first day of the week. "But this I say, he which soweth sparingly shall reap also sparingly, and he which soweth bountifully shall reap also bountifully. Every man according as he purposeth in his heart, so let him give, not grudgingly or of necessity, for God loveth the cheerful giver, and God is able to make all grace abound toward you, that ye, always having all sufficiency in all things, may abound to every good work." Now he says there that this giving that we do is a sowing. And if we sow sparingly, we can expect to reap sparingly. If we sow bountifully, we can expect to reap bountifully. But we're to purpose in our heart and to give cheerfully. God doesn't want us to give grudgingly. He loveth a cheerful giver. And then he concludes in the 8th verse, "And God is able to make all grace abound toward you," so that regardless of how much we give, God is still able to make us prosper. He's able to make all grace abound toward you, that ye always, having all sufficiency in all things, may abound to every good work. So God has promised that this giving that we do only allows him to make all grace abound even that much more to us. And a person could never say, if he gave the percentage of 10%, he could never say, I made myself poor because I gave 10%. Because it's a sliding scale, and the less you have, the less that 10% would be. The more you have, that 10% is still only a tenth of what you do have. So it's not going to break anybody to give a 10%. It certainly did in the Old Testament, and as we studied in the 14th chapter, there was possibly even two tithes given, which would be close to 20% rather than just 10%. Well, let's move on into our chapter at this time, the 15th chapter. In this 15th chapter, he is still giving them some particulars of the law, how they are to keep these various items of the law. And he mentions three subjects in this chapter that are most interesting. In the first verse of chapter 15 of Deuteronomy, "At the end of every 7 years thou shalt make a release." Now this word "release" is also translated by some as "remission." Thou shalt make a remission. Now let's look just for a minute at this thing of 7 years. Every seventh year, known as a sabbatical year, several things happened. They did not plant their crops. They did not harvest the vineyards as they ordinarily would. But the fields and crops lay at rest, and what grew at random there was gathered by whoever happened to come along and have need of it. The land was not actively cultivated and farmed and harvested during that seventh year. And then when seven of these sabbatical years had passed, that would be 49 years, then that 50th year was known as the year of Jubilee. Now, on the year of Jubilee, the land also laid fallow like it did on the previous year, that 49th year, which was one of the seventh or sabbatical years. It also laid fallow. But also on the year of Jubilee, all the land that had been sold since the previous Jubilee went back to its original owner. So that the land, then every 50 years, would all go back to the original owners, the original tribe that God had distributed the land to, and consequently the wealth then would be redistributed as it was originally given when they took the land of Canaan. And of course, if a person bought a piece of land, say it was 5 years from the Jubilee, that would be taken into consideration, and the price would be much less because he would only have use of it for 5 years. And so this is an interesting fact of economics. And I've heard some of the economists say, talking about not Bible economics, but the economics of modern day, that in order for a country to be solvent and not to have the great depths of depression or the great ravishes of inflation, that there had to be some kind of a procedure made for the land to go back to its original owner. I don't understand all of it that was intended by that, but I do know that in the Old Testament, this land went back to the original owner every 50 years, or to the original tribe. Well, in this chapter, he says, at the end of every 7 years, thou shalt make a release. Now, he mentions some other things that happened in the 7 years besides the land laying fallow. Verse 2, and this is the manner of the release. Every creditor that lendeth aught unto his neighbor shall release it. He shall not exact it of his neighbor or of his brother, because it is called the Lord's release. Now, what this means is everybody who had loaned any money to a brother or to a kinsman, a fellow Israelite, or to a person you were kin to in the flesh, if you loaned him any money, when the seventh year came, then you were to cancel the debt. You could not collect the debt. It was called the Lord's release, and you shall not exact it of your neighbor or of your brother. Now, as I understand it, this seventh year began in the seventh month. Of a foreigner thou mayest exact it again, but that which is thine with thy brother thine hand shall release. Now, this seems like a real strange rule to us, that you could loan somebody some money, and when the seventh year came, then you would have to forfeit the money. It was just his money to keep, because this was release that is said about here. But we see that there is a purpose behind this. This is a way that God had for the wealth to be more equally distributed. It wouldn't make it really equal, but it would be more equal, so that one person wouldn't have a lot of wealth and another person have a lot of poverty, without some kind of inequality. The person who had the wealth, who had the means, would simply loan this poor person the money. Now, if the poor person could pay the money back, that's fine. That's well and good. Arrangements were made for him to pay it back. But if he came to this seventh year and he hadn't been able to pay it back, then the debt was canceled. And so what it really means is it's a way of giving the poor something. You give them something, they have an opportunity, they have some obligation to pay it back, but if they're just not able to accomplish that, then it's given to them and it's not held against them. Now, that's the Bible way of extending welfare or charity from the rich to the poor. So that the poor had an obligation. They were free to discharge that obligation if they had the means and if they had the willingness to do so. But in the last analysis, if they just couldn't pay, then the debt was canceled. Now, we read a little bit more about this. In the fourth verse, he says, save when there shall be no poor among you. Now, some of the ancient translators translate that in the margin to read this way. To the end, there shall be no poor among you. Now, that's really a more proper translation in accordance with the context here, because it says later down in this same passage that there's going to be poor among you always. So I don't think he means that this law is not going to apply when there's no poor among you. He means this law is applied to work to the end that there wouldn't be poor, that there wouldn't be those who just had to do without. So, save when there shall be no poor among you, for the Lord shall greatly bless thee in the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee for an inheritance to possess it. Now, this is the way that the state of the poor would be improved. The Lord's going to greatly bless you, and then you will use this rule here to distribute what you have with the poor. And that's just like what we read over there in 2 Corinthians 8:14 a few minutes ago, where he says that to be inequality, that your abundance now should be a supply to their want, that their abundance might be a supply to your want, that there might be inequality. And then he quoted from the time of the gathering of the manna, he that gathered much didn't have any left over, and he that gathered little had no lack. Now, verse 5, only if thou carefully hearken unto the voice of the Lord thy God to observe to do all these commandments which I command thee this day. Now, that's the only way that he was going to bless them greatly in that land. That's the only way he's going to make them prosperous, is to carefully hearken to the voice of the Lord thy God and observe to do all these commandments which I command thee this day. So these commandments had to be done before the blessing would really be given. The blessings were conditional. They were conditional on the keeping of the commandments. And we keep coming back with this same theme over and over and over again. I will bless you if you keep my commandments. That's over and over again. It's taught here in Deuteronomy numerous times. It's taught in the New Testament numerous times. And we know that it is truly one of the principles of God's law. We have to do the commands if we're going to be blessed. That's just the way it is. Verse 6, for the Lord thy God blesseth thee, as he promised thee, and thou shalt lend unto many nations, but thou shalt not borrow, and thou shalt reign over many nations, but they shall not reign over thee. There's another one of God's rules that he wanted his people to follow, and it sounds like a good rule for us now. Thou shalt lend unto many nations, but thou shalt not borrow. He did not intend for his nation to be a borrowing nation. And it also, of course, stands to reason that we as families would do much better if we didn't have to borrow. And that's one of the troubles with the economy of this nation today. They've given everybody so much tremendous borrowing power so that they have more buying power than they have paying power. And consequently, inflation is running rampant, and it is a dangerous a threat to the solvency of this nation today because of that. So he tells Israel that, thou shalt not borrow, and thou shalt reign over many nations, but they shall not reign over thee. This ability to be able to lend and not have to borrow has to do a whole lot with your ability to be able to reign and not be reigned over. In Proverbs 22:7, a statement is made there that is very interesting. The rich ruleth over the poor, and the borrower is servant to the lender. That's one of the Proverbs. The rich rule over the poor, and the borrower is servant to the lender. So the more we borrow, the more we become a servant then to the lender. And God's principle for his people was that they not be borrowers. They could be lenders, but not borrowers. If there be any among you, a poor man of one of thy brethren within any of thy gates in thy land, which the Lord thy God giveth thee, thou shalt not harden thine heart, nor shut thine hand from thy poor brother. Now, this thing gets a little bit more binding. It's not just a matter of somebody happens to make a loan from you and he happens not to pay it back by the seventh year that you release him. It's a matter of if he has a need, if he's a poor man and he has a need, he says, thou shalt not harden thine heart nor shut thine hand from thy poor brother. Now there's two things here. First of all is the heart or your mind. You're not to harden your heart against him. That is, you're not to take on an attitude in which you have no compassion, no sympathy or empathy for this poor person. And the second thing is, you're not to shut your hand from him. That is, you're not to refuse to let him have the things that he needs that you can provide him. Do not shut your hand from him, from that poor brother. But thou shalt open thine hand wide unto him, and shall surely lend him sufficient for his need in that which he wanteth. Now that makes it pretty binding there. He forbids them to think the wrong way or to do the wrong way towards the poor. Now he takes it a step further in the next verse. Beware that there be not a thought in thy wicked heart, saying, the seventh year, the year of release is at hand, and thine eye be evil against thy poor brother, and thou givest him naught, and he cry unto the Lord against thee, and it be sin unto thee. Now here the Bible has already looked ahead as to what may happen. Here a person has the money, another one wants to borrow it, and here the seventh year's coming up pretty soon. Maybe it's going to be 8 months away, or maybe 18 months away. And he sees, well, that seventh year is right at hand, and if I give him the money now, I won't get it back. Well, the Bible says that that's a thought in thy wicked heart. Beware that there be not a thought in thy wicked heart, saying, the seventh year, the year of release is at hand, and thine eye be evil against thy poor brother, and thou givest him naught. He says you're not to think those thoughts. You're not to think about the fact that, am I going to get this back or not? Planning, when you give to the poor, how am I going to be repaid? Am I going to get it back? He says, that's an evil thought to think like that. So you see what this idea of the release is. It's really a way of extending charity, and as we'd call it in our society today, welfare to those who have need. Now, they do have an opportunity to pay it back. It's not just like here, I'm giving you a gift. They have a chance to pay it back, and if they're able to pay it back, the opportunity is there. But you can't force them to pay after the seventh year. So he says, and thine eye be evil against thy poor brother, and thou givest him naught, and he cry against the Lord, unto the Lord against thee, and it be sin unto thee. If you refuse to give it to him and he cries to the Lord, it's sin for you to have refused. Now that's taking it just about as much as you can to make it a binding law. That's just not just a little frivolous, nice to do it if you want to rule that he has here. It's sin if you give him nothing when he has need, even though the year of release is at hand. Thou shalt surely give him, and one translation says, thou shalt surely give him freely, and thine heart shall not be grieved when thou givest unto him. Now this gets into the very way we're supposed to think, our very attitude. We're not supposed to be grieved when we give it. Now I know I've had occasion in the past when I have helped people, but I had such a bad taste in my mouth after having done it until I'm sure it didn't account to any good for me to have done it, because my heart was grieved because I felt like the people really didn't appreciate it. Now, he doesn't take that into consideration about whether or not they appreciate it. He says that thou shalt give to him freely, and thine heart shall not be grieved when thou givest unto him. Because that for this thing the Lord thy God shall bless thee in all thy works and in all that thou puttest thy hand unto. That's the reason for it. The Lord's going to bless you for having done this. So why should we feel grieved about something when the Lord's promised he's going to bless us? And we just read over there in 2 Corinthians 9 where he says, he that soweth sparingly shall reap sparingly, but he that soweth bountifully shall reap bountifully. That's New Testament. He's promised us that. And so if we sow and we expect to reap, but we have a bad feeling because we sowed, then we haven't done right. It's just like a farmer going out here and planting the seed, and he begrudges having to put those seed in the ground, knowing that each one's going to give him multifold back more than he put out. And a farmer's glad to put the seed down because he knows the results of it. He wants to put good seed down. He wants to put enough seed down. He wants to do it at the right time so it'll be productive for him. He doesn't begrudge that. If he does, if he holds back on the seed, he's not going to prosper. And so it is with God's people. He there definitely sets out this rule here. We're not to have this feeling of begrudging it when we give. And this is the way, then, that God dispels poverty among the people. He wanted a nation that would be solvent. He wanted a nation to be self-sufficient. A nation that would provide for their own. And this was his way of doing it. The rich gave to the poor. Now, he eliminates all of the tremendous waste that's taken on by the middlemen of government, where the taxes are extracted and this agency and this bureaucracy and this group gets it and they distribute it and they all get their cut out of it before it finally gets down to the poor person who needs it. And then when the poor person needs it, it's just given to him with no incentive to work or to pay it back or no obligation whatsoever. He eliminates all of that. It goes directly from the person who has the money to the person who has the need, and then the transaction is between those two. But if the poor person can't pay it back in the seventh year, the debt is canceled. Now, this thought came to my mind as I was studying this. Our Savior, as he gave the example of how to pray in Matthew 6, he said, "Forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors." And it never occurred to me before, as I studied that prayer, about this idea of what's taught here in Deuteronomy 15. Here is a situation in Deuteronomy 15 in which they were to forgive their debtors. There was a time coming when the debtor was to be forgiven. But as we stop and think, there are things in our lives in which we owe to God, in which only God can forgive. And as I mentioned, this release here is translated by some of the scholars as remission. God gives us a release. God gives us a remission. God forgives us our debts as we forgive our debtors. Now, if we're not willing to forgive our debtors, the prayer is, "Do you forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors?" So if we fail to forgive our debtors, then there is no promise that God's going to forgive us our debts that we owe to Him. And this is taught by parables by Jesus, this principle of the servant who had somebody owe him something and he wouldn't forgive, but yet he went to his master and asked for forgiveness himself. And the same way it would be with us. If we ask God, "Oh, forgive me of my sins, God, and my sins are great and they're numerous and I want forgiveness, but I will not forgive this poor man of the debt that he owes me." See the difference there. And Jesus was praying this Lord's Prayer under this same law here that we read about in Deuteronomy 15. So it's a very interesting principle that God lays down here, one that was intended for His people, and no doubt it would work if it was put into effect, and these same principles apply to us today. So let's be willing to help the poor. Give them an opportunity, an incentive maybe to work or to repay it if they're able to, but also be just as willing to forgive the debt. Now, this didn't apply to a foreigner. He said, "Of a foreigner, thou mayest exact it again." So the foreigner's debt wasn't canceled. It was only within the nation of Israel, applying to a fellow member of the household of God or to a kinsman. Now, beginning in the 11th verse, he says, "For the poor shall never cease out of the land. Therefore I command thee, saying, Thou shalt open thine hand wide unto thy brother, to thy poor, and to thy needy in thy land." Very interesting passage there, talking about this seventh year. Beginning in the 12th verse, he takes on another subject about this seventh year. And if thy brother, an Hebrew man, or an Hebrew woman, be sold unto thee, and serve thee 6 years, then in the seventh year thou shalt let him go free from thee. Now this is a very interesting subject about a slave or a servant. It seems that a person could sell himself as a slave. For example, if he was in poverty and just had to have some dire assistance in that way, he could sell himself as a servant. Or a person could be sold by their parents due to poverty and have to serve out a time of servitude. Or a person could be sold by the court of judgment for some crime that he had committed. But nevertheless, when the person was sold into this state of slavery or bondage, when the 7 years was up, on this seventh year, they had to be released. And when thou, verse 13, when thou sendest him out free from thee, thou shalt not let him go away empty. Thou shalt furnish him liberally out of thy flock and out of thy floor, and out of thy wine press. Of course, the flock would have to do with the sheep, and the floor would have to do with the grain and produce he'd harvested, and the wine press would be the wine. Of that wherewith the Lord thy God hath blessed thee, thou shalt give unto him. So this person, when he was released from his bondage, he was not sent away empty-handed, but he was given some goods to go with him, according to how well his master had prospered. And thou shalt remember that thou wast a bondman in the land of Egypt, and the Lord thy God redeemed thee. Therefore I command thee this thing today. And it shall be, if he say unto thee, I will not go away from thee, because he loveth thee, and thine house, because he is well with thee, then thou shalt take an awl and thrust it through his ear under the door, and he shall be thy servant forever. And also unto thy maidservant thou shalt do likewise. So if this person decided he didn't want to be released, he didn't want to leave, he wanted to stay, he liked this place, he liked to work for this master, he liked the situation there, then he took an awl and he thrust it through his ear up against the door. I don't know exactly what kind of a situation that would be, but this is mentioned several times here. Just punched a hole in his ear with this awl up against the door, and then he would be a servant forever. Then he would do the same unto the maidservant. It shall not seem hard unto thee when thou sendest him away free from thee, for he hath been worth a double hired servant to thee in serving thee 6 years, and the Lord thy God shall bless thee in all that thou doest. Now when he talks about a double hired servant, we have a glimpse of what a hired servant is in Isaiah 16 verse 14, where he talks about a servant who worked for wages for 3 years. Now, if you had a hired servant, his time of stay was 3 years, not 6 years, but 3 years. And he got paid for what he did. And then at the end of the 3 years, apparently he was released from his servitude. But this person we're talking about here in this chapter is worth a double hired servant because he worked not only 3 years, he worked 6 years, and he worked without pay. So he's like a double hired servant. And so he says you shouldn't grudge in your heart. It shouldn't seem a hard thing to you when you send him away free from thee, because he's been worth a double hired servant. You'd be willing to take a servant and pay him, and this person is worth a double hired servant because he not only worked without pay, but he worked for the 6 years instead of the three. And the Lord thy God shall bless thee in all that thou doest. It seems that slavery here was really to the intent of coming to a point where the slave came out with more than he went in with. He had somehow or other gotten out of his debt. He had been allowed to survive with food and clothing and his needs. Plus, when he left, he had part of the flock, and he had part of the floor, and he had part of the wine press. Now, to shed a little bit more light on this subject about the servants, the slaves, I'd like to turn to Exodus 21, and there begin reading at the second verse, where we have some more said about this. Now, this subject of the indentured servants is a rather complex subject, and there are many things about it that are difficult to understand. But in order to help us have more completeness, I would like to read from this Exodus 21. Verse 2 of Exodus 21. If thou buy an Hebrew servant, 6 years shall he serve, and in the seventh he shall go out free for nothing. Now notice here he says, if thou buy a Hebrew servant. So the person, because of some kind of poverty, went into this servantship, and the person who bought him paid out some money to somebody, maybe to him, maybe to his parents, maybe to the court of judgment, but money was paid out. So this person is working himself out of a bind. So if thou buy a Hebrew servant, 6 years shall he serve, and in the seventh he shall go out free for nothing. If he came in by himself, he shall go out by himself. If he were married, then his wife shall go out with him. Now here's an interesting and difficult part to explain. Verse 4. If his master have given him a wife, and she have borne him sons or daughters, the wife and her children shall be her master's, and he shall go out by himself. And if the servant shall plainly say, I love my master, my wife, and my children, I will not go out free, then his master shall bring him unto the judges. He shall also bring him to the door or unto the doorpost, and his master shall bore his ear through with an awl, and he shall serve him forever. So it seems that the marriage that he had, I don't know just how binding this marriage was, but if he, at the end of his servitude, if he wanted to go out free, he couldn't take the wife and children with him. They still belong to the master. He says nothing about being able for this man to be able to marry again. Nothing about him being free to remarry. He just says he couldn't take them with him because he'd gotten them in servitude and they still belong to the master. So that's an interesting point there, and I'm sure that there are other ramifications, because we think, well, if the woman had gone in at the same time he went in, at the end of the 7 years, she'd be free too. But apparently she was a servant that was not free to go. She had somehow been made to serve forever. Now, verse 7 is another interesting thing. If a man sell his daughter to be a maidservant, she shall not go out as the men servants do. Now, it seems that this selling of the daughters had with it the idea that the one who bought the daughter would buy her to marry her. He would buy her to be betrothed to her, or maybe to betroth his son to her. So she wasn't free to go out like the men servants were. If she please not her master, who hath betrothed her to himself, then shall he let her be redeemed. To sell her unto a strange nation he shall have no power, seeing he hath dealt deceitfully with her. So he bought her with the idea of marrying her, but if she doesn't please him and he doesn't want to marry her, then he has to redeem her. And if he have betrothed her unto his son, he shall deal with her after the manner of daughters. So if he did have his son to marry, then she's just like another daughter. Now, in order, first of all, for a parent to sell their daughter in this situation, no doubt they would pick somebody that was wealthy, somebody that was respected, and in their own mind, they thought they would be doing the best thing for the daughter. I mean, they wouldn't sell the daughter to someone who couldn't provide for her, who wouldn't be a suitable husband and so on in their own mind. So they were trying to get their daughter to take a step up out of poverty into a higher section of society. Now he goes on in verse 10, if he take him another wife, her food, her raiment, and her duty of marriage shall not be diminished. This person decides that he wants to take another wife instead of this one. She still gets the same amount of food and raiment and duty of marriage that she would have gotten otherwise. And if he do not these three unto her, then shall she go out free without money. So this then would make her free, actually, if he didn't give her all the duties that went along with marriage as though he had married her. So that's an interesting addition to this idea about the slave, the indentured servant, being freed on the seventh year. So you see, this seventh year had several things to happen. Now as we move on in our chapter, Deuteronomy 15, to the 19th verse, he has another subject. All the firstling males that come out of thy herd and of thy flock, thou shalt sanctify unto the Lord thy God. Thou shalt do no work with the firstling of thy bullock, nor shear the firstling of thy sheep. Now this rule about the firstling males, and really the firstborn of all the flock, is that the firstborn belongs to God. This is true not only of the animals in the field, but it's also true of the human beings. The firstborn belongs to God. Now the rule states, though, that the firstborn humans can be redeemed from God, and the firstborn of the unclean animals can be redeemed from God. But the firstborn of the clean animals could not be redeemed from God. They had to be given to God. Now you remember in the case of Jesus, when he was 40 days old, Joseph and Mary took him down to the temple to redeem him, because he really belonged to the Lord like all the other firstborn males. They took him to the temple to redeem him. And that's where they met Annas the prophetess and also Simon the prophet. And that's how we know he was 40 days old before the wise men came, because they'd already been to Jerusalem to the temple and back before the wise men came. But in this passage, in Deuteronomy 15, verse 19, he's talking about the males. He's talking about the ones that come out of thy herd and of thy flock. So they're clean animals. Thou shalt sanctify the Lord thy God. They cannot redeem them. They have to be given to God. Now, some of these scholars think that the rest of this verse has to do with the females that are firstborn. He says, thou shalt do no work with the firstling of thy bullock, nor shear the firstling of thy sheep. Now, that wouldn't really apply to the firstling males, because the firstling males were taken on the eighth day. They were given to God, and they were divided between the priest and the altar. Part went to the priest, part was sacrificed on the altar on the eighth day. So he wouldn't be talking about doing work with an eight-day-old animal or shearing an eight-day-old animal. So no doubt this idea of applying to the females was the more correct interpretation. Now, the females weren't taken right away, but they were soon used to be eaten. And they couldn't do any work with them, and they couldn't shear them, so they were not to be used for a profit. Verse 20, thou shalt eat it before the Lord thy God year by year, in the place which the Lord shall choose, thou and thy household. So this was to be done before the year was up. It was to be eaten wherever the Lord should to choose, in thy household. And if there be any blemish therein, as if it be lame or blind or have any ill blemish, thou shalt not sacrifice it unto the Lord thy God. So the blemished animals could not be sacrificed. Thou shalt eat it within thy gates. The clean, the unclean and the clean person shall eat it alike, as the roebuck and as the hart. Now, you know, we talked about there were certain things that made a person unclean. To touch a dead person, or to be in the vicinity of a dead person. A woman's, so many days after she'd given birth to a child, certain diseases made them unclean. And we discussed that earlier. But in this situation of the animal with the blemish, the unclean could eat it just like the clean could. Verse 23, only thou shalt not eat the blood thereof, thou shalt pour it upon the ground as water. So here again we have reminded that they're not to eat the blood. The blood's to be poured out just like water. It's not to be consumed. So this little chapter has three interesting areas. One about the lending to the poor and that debt being forgiven on the seventh year. Second one about the indentured servants and them being freed on the seventh year. And thirdly about the firstling males belonging to God and how they were to attend to that. And so we're going to conclude at that point. Next time then, Lord willing, we'll begin with the 16th chapter of Deuteronomy.